grab your windbreaker and your finest fisherman's hat, because there's a nor'easter a-blowing. Actually, no, there's not. But we are talking with an aerodynamicist this week on the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast. Steve Stafford is along to talk about all things aero and share some of his big brain with you folks on the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast, episode 27. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome once again to the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast. I am JG Pastorjack. This is the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast, as I just mentioned, the official podcast of Grassroots Motorsports Magazine and Classic Motorsports Magazine. Big fun show today. Steve Stafford is with us. He is an old friend of the magazine, and we'll explain more about what he does and who he is in a second. But first, let me tell you about a great deal that we can offer you at Grassroots Motorsports Magazine. If you are a listener to the podcast, and if you are, I thank you very much for that, you can get a 20% discount off of your new or renewal subscription to our podcast just by a new or renewal subscription to our magazine just by listening to our podcast. That is the gift that we give you for being a listener. And actually, I've gotten some really nice emails and some in-person comments at events in the past week or two from folks, and I really want to thank you guys for listening. Gotten some really good feedback lately, so thanks everybody for that. But 20% off Grassroots Motorsports or Classic Motorsports for a new subscription or a renewal subscription just by going to grassrootsmotorsports.com/discount or classicmotorsports.net/discount. I heard those websites were actually not working up weeks ago, which proved to me that somebody was listening to the podcast. It was just a test, but they are all fixed now. And just by going there, you're going to get like a 20% break. So, you know, it might be 18 or 21 or somewhere right around there. It's a pretty substantial discount, though, to either of our magazines just by being listener to the podcast. So that's our commercial plug for the week. So let's talk about Steve Stafford. We first met Steve way back in the day. He's kind of one of our old Daytona crew. From way back in the day, you know, when I first started here at the magazine, which was, you know, 1990, we knew Steve just from, you know, local sports car stuff. He was a Spitfire guy way back in the day, kind of, you know, hung around with the local racing scene and stuff. And, you know, was a student at Embry-Riddle University, which is one of the preeminent aeronautical universities in the world, really. And from there went on to a very, very cool career in the aerodynamics field, working primarily with motorsports. Went to a wind tunnel where he worked for Swift Engineering, and then, you know, went to Toyota and Saleen and did all this really cool stuff. So basically, you know, he got the education that everybody needs to do that stuff, and then went on to do the stuff that everybody wants to do with that education. You know, he's not sitting in a cube somewhere designing, you know, wings for some, you know, for a windmill that's gonna run somebody's pump somewhere, you know, or something very sort of, not that that would be boring and industrial, but, you know, something not nearly as sexy as working on race cars all day, which is what he gets to do, which is exceedingly cool. So yeah, and he's, like I say, a good friend we've known from way back. Actually, before she was my wife, he used to date my wife way back in the day. And, you know, personally, I'm glad it didn't work out for them. But man, did she get the short end of the stick on this one. I mean, just, you know, she, well, listened to the podcast and, you know, she could have had this guy that worked for Toyota and Saleen and is designing cars that went to Le Mans, or a guy that, you know, would one day host a podcast, which I guess is okay. So that's our buddy Steve. So we're very, very happy to have him on. And actually, if you have questions for him, he is a regular member as much as he can be with his busy schedule on our message board at grassrootsmotorsports.com, our website. He's on there under the name Stafford1500, I think. So if you have any aero questions for him, we'll throw a thread up and he'll keep an eye on it. And he's a very regular lurker on there at the very least, and chimes in whenever he has time or whenever there's good questions. So you guys have the opportunity to sort of interact with one of our guests this week, which is very cool. So let's just head right out to our chat with Steve, talk about all kinds of different as grassroots as we can get with aero stuff, relating it to autocross and you know, I'm not very bright, so I tried to make it as basic as I possibly could, question wise, just ask him, questions that I'd be interested in, and have him not hurt my head so bad with the answers. So I think we did a pretty good job at kind of covering a lot of different subjects when it comes to aero stuff. Some fascinating stuff there really is. So let us, without any further ado then, cut to our interview with Mr. Steve Stafford. Please enjoy. Let's just get things started. Steve Stafford is with us on the GRM podcast this week. Now, if you don't know Steve, you may have seen some of his writings in the magazine before. He is an old friend of the magazine from way back in the Daytona sports car scene. When we first met you, I think you were still a student at Embry-Riddle University and just kind of hanging out in the local Daytona sports car scene. And Embry-Riddle, obviously being one of the world's foremost aeronautical colleges, you went on to a career in the aerodynamics field and in everybody's dream of auto racing. So take us just kind of quickly take us through your career after you graduated and how'd you end up where you are now.
Well, the career path actually started while I was still in college. All the local sports car stuff, basically working with some local club racing teams and autocross guys and starting to help kind of engineer and develop cars for those guys. And in the end, that mixed with my knowledge of the aerodynamics field from university offered me an opportunity to hire on with a company that had a wind tunnel out in California at Swift Engineering. And in the end, wound up working there at their tunnel for a couple of years, and then wound up on the road and with their Champ Car team at the time, having I guess proved myself to the engineering group there, and then wound up working on a little bit of everything while I was there, because the tunnel was a customer tunnel, so we wound up working on F1 cars, Champ Cars, drag cars, stock cars, sports cars. I think the only thing we didn't see in the tunnel was a motorcycle, to be honest. And then wound up hiring on with Toyota from there, and again working on Champ Cars and Indy Cars and sports cars. And then after a couple of years, took an opportunity to go do sports cars in Europe. So traveling back and forth to Europe from California, working with Celine and doing the European sports tour, European Le Mans series, which was obviously the European version of the American Le Mans series, and then signing back on with Toyota after a couple of years and doing NASCAR stuff and a little bit of sports car stuff on the side and some one-off projects.
So this is going to be a kind of a tough podcast, because I think aerodynamics is one of those things for me anyway, that when you start sort of exploring it out to where things start having an effect and to where you actually start to try and mathematically understand it, it's hard to really grasp it in any sense, but a mathematical sense almost. Like, you know, if you look around, there's Newtonian physics all around us every day. There's motion and reaction and all this stuff, but wind and air is this sort of, you know, amorphous, almost philosophical concept that we kind of think we understand just intuitively, but when you start studying the math, I think the math becomes a little counterintuitive for somebody that just sort of has a rudimentary understanding of Newtonian physics. So the math
is, simplistically, there's only a few equations that control it all. The problem is that those equations get really big and hairy really quick. But it is something that's really hard to visualize for a lot of people. And I spend a lot of time in the tunnel with guys that have been doing this for their entire careers without having any real aerodynamicist type background other than they've been doing it. And they sometimes, you know, have a mental idea of how the air is moving around the car. But at the end of the day, it is a really difficult thing to imagine. And we normally think of things engineering wise on a piece of paper, you know, it's got two dimensions and air being what it is, doesn't really obey that second dimension. It's more than welcome to move in that third dimension. That's a really difficult thing for a lot of people to grasp.
So give us some perspective here. Like, what, give us an idea of the types and the magnitudes of forces that we're dealing with when we're talking about aerodynamic forces. I think, you know, for one thing, it's probably fair to say that the, you know, the most of the work that a car's engine does obviously is overcoming aerodynamic drag up, you know, beyond just walking speeds, basically. But can I give us some perspective on some of the actual forces we're talking about and levels and magnitudes?
Yeah, the typical production car, which most of the grassroots guys are kind of basing their vehicles on, with a few exceptions for home-built dedicated race cars, is up to about 60, 70 miles an hour, the drag of all the mechanicals on the car really takes precedent. Beyond that, the aerodynamics starts to play a bigger effect. Right about 60, 70 miles an hour is kind of your break-even point. So going down the highway, your motor's halfway working against the aerodynamic loads and halfway against the mechanical loads. We did the coast down analysis on the Beetle a while back and put the spreadsheet on the web on the site, and I think if you look at that, I forget what the drag load was, the physical load, but it was in the order of tens of pounds, or maybe pushing 100 pounds with the sticky tires that you had. But ultimately, the engine is effectively overcoming both mechanical and the aero, and about 60, 70 miles an hour is the break-even point between the two. So anything faster than that, and you're starting to work against the air. And the aero loads increase extremely rapidly. So doubling the speed quadruples the drag force. So it jumps up very quickly.
And then when you start talking about aero loads affecting the handling balance of a car, what kind of loads become significant? I mean, you hear about, okay, well, this splitter produces 30, 40 pounds of downforce. Is that a lot? What becomes a lot, and what becomes, what type of numbers become significant, and sort of, you know, what type of numbers does it take to make a real effect on lap times or the perceived feel of a car?
Unfortunately, because everything goes through the tire, the threshold for what someone can feel making a difference on a lap time, or seeing on a stopwatch or on their lap timer, is really a function of the tire. But if we just assume an average tire that is the same for everything, every bit of aero load that increases downforce on a tire, whether it's 1 pound or 100 pounds, makes a difference. It's a matter of how much is measurable, obviously. And generally speaking, the you're going to have to look at it as a function of car weight. So if each corner of the car weighs, let's call it 700 pounds, if you're making an extra 100 pounds on one corner of the car or 400 across the whole car, you're looking at, let's see, that's 400 pounds out of 3,000 pounds. So you're looking at maybe a 10%, right around a 10% increase in physical load on the tires, vertical force. And that 10% is probably not going to translate to a 10% gain in lap time, but it is going to gain some small amount of lap time. So I
would imagine that since aerodynamics is so hard for somebody without access to a tunnel or without access to certain test equipment, it's hard for them to really get a gauge on what's working and what's not. And I would imagine there's probably a lot of people out there dealing with problems that they're chasing other places that may have been aero problems all along that they just didn't realize, especially, you know, on a track car or a road race car that they had just never really thought about. So what's some of the stuff that somebody without access to a wind tunnel or without access to any sort of, you know, complicated test equipment, how can we get a handle on just what's going on aerodynamically with our cars at speed and if it's having an effect or if it's having a negative effect?
The most basic piece of equipment that most people have for autocross and or road course kind of track work is a stopwatch. And honestly, if you can break up corners, you know, so break out your point from entry to some exit point on the corner, and if you're making an aero change, try and log your time across that distance or a series of corners. And ultimately, the aero is going to help you more significantly with cornering forces with more tire grip effectively. So if you can break out the corners versus straightaways, so instead of looking at the entire lap time where you may be losing on the straightaway due to drag, but you're gaining in the corners, if you can break out that you're actually gaining in the corners, you're obviously helping yourself with downforce at that point. But the tools to look at, you know, how much the balance changes would be things like tire temperatures and you know indications of odd wear, where you've got the tires getting physically hot because they've got extra load, carrying more speed through the corner, things like that. So it can be as simple as the basic tools of a tire temp probe and a stopwatch.
So what, there's been all kinds of influx of aero. Actually, there's a ton of used Car Tomorrow wings out there on the secondary market now that those are no longer, you know, used in NASCAR, and a lot of road race guys are buying those and using them. And there's a lot of aero now finding its way into some of the more highly modified autocross classes. Obviously, you know, A modified's always been a very heavy aero class because there's a lot of wing area allowed in that class. But now we're seeing some of the production based cars like street modified cars adopting a lot of aero stuff. And there seems to be some out there that have a plan, and there seems to be some out there that are just throwing stuff at the car and seeing what works. If you were going to start a project like that with no prior knowledge, is there a particular, like, let's say you're starting with, you know, a generic production car, could be a Miata, could be a Honda Civic, you know, is there usually an aerodynamically weak area in most production cars that's something, you know, a first thing you want to deal with?
Just about every production car winds up with some amount of downforce on the front, and either a very small amount of downforce or more likely lift at the rear. So most production cars are very light at the rear. So it would always benefit to kind of start with rear downforce. Talking about people just kind of throwing things on and not really seeming to have a plan, a lot of times what you see is people putting wings on and splitters on and things like that. And because those are really out in the air, out in the open, and kind of working sort of kind of by themselves, there's a higher drag penalty to some of those items than there are to some of the more subtle things that are harder to see, like underbody pans and trays and things like that. And then you mentioned AMOD, and I believe it was this past year, one of the Formula SAE cars showed up with a wing assembly that was split left to right, and the wings changed angle of attack depending on which way they turned the steering wheel to benefit the inside of the car with more downforce. So on the inside of the corner. So there's some places that, you know, where you can take advantage of that. And I've seen a bit on the forum about people making active wings based on throttle and brake and things like that as well. So as far as first direction, I would say most production cars need rear downforce primarily. However, a rear wing is probably not the most efficient way to make it.
So is there any way in some of these more lightly modified classes, let's say you can't use a wing or you can't add any sort of under trays or anything you can do with inherent setup, like just changing the rake a little bit maybe? Or?
Absolutely. The actual height of the car, the whole attitude of the car is one of the biggest items you can adjust to get the drag down and potentially generate downforce. The idea of putting some pitch into the car, basically dropping the front or raising the rear if you're less able to lower the front, will generate some downforce that's reasonably balanced between front and rear. But again, you're still going to be dealing with a car that's front heavy on downforce. So you may actually make it a little more loose by trying to put pitch in it, just changing attitude. However, dropping the whole car is generally very, very efficient for taking drag out of it. So if you can get the car physically lower or perhaps even tail down more than the front, you can take drag out of it. But doing that, you're going to wind up taking some rear downforce out of it faster than you take front downforce out. So again, you get a little bit of a loose situation.
So what's out there right now that you actually like aerodynamically? I mean, there was a big push in the late 80s when headlights started to get flushed in and flush glass was a big thing and greenhouses started to become very, very smooth. And manufacturers seem to have gotten away from that a little bit, but they've managed to keep drag coefficients, about the same level as they were back then. But I mean, I'm sure they're doing it other ways and using much, more precise design software and stuff like that. But is there anything out there right now that you've seen production car wise that kind of made you think, oh, that's a cool idea what they're doing to control the air there?
Yeah, most of you were talking about the shapes are starting to change a little bit from the, Faraday and everything. In the mid-90s, the early mid-90s, everything was kind of jelly bean shaped. And now they've started to move away from that. And then, like you say, the CDs haven't really changed. And what's happening is they're getting to the point where they can control that drag, even with these kind of odd bulbous headlight and turn signal shapes. And what winds up happening is they're using those shapes to control noise and vibrations on the car. So they're actually using the little bumps and stuff on the mirrors and headlights and places like that, and taillights even, to control the noise and the vibrations that transmit into the car. So that's primarily where that's come from. Some of it's styling. I imagine they kind of feed back on each other, where if they find a drag benefit by making it a little bit bulbous, the design guys, the styling guys say, well, if some's good, more must be better, which is a typical race car mentality. But usually bites you in the butt that way.
So I think one of the things that gets overlooked a lot with aero is everybody is obviously very, very concerned when they start talking about aero, or when the layman's do anyway, is how air flows through something or around something or over something. But I think they kind of overlook at times how air stacks up in certain areas, and like if you look at Daytona prototype cars, Le Mans sports cars, they all have those vents over the wheels, which is precisely so in high yaw incidents, the air doesn't stack up on top of the wheel wells and push the car over, essentially. So, you know, is that as important as it seems to kind of not just think about air going around something, but getting air out of these sort of enclosed areas as well?
Yeah, I mean, you can think of it kind of as a parachute or a kite. I mean, it's ultimately, if you've got a big cavity, the air does fill it up and pressurize it just ever so slightly above atmospheric. And that's why things like hood scoops and things like that work for regaining the pressure losses in an intake system. Basically, you're filling it up with as much air as it can hold, and then the rest of it spills over, so you're getting spillage around it, but if it's on the underbody, especially wheel wells, if you've got a high pressure area there, you're effectively pushing the car up at the same time you're trying to make downforce to pull the thing down to the ground. So if you've got a high pressure area, your benefit would be to absolutely vent it. And if you're trying to balance a car, a production-based car that doesn't have any benefit of external wings or splitters or anything like that, it used to be done, everyone seemed to think it was a cooling issue or a cooling fix, cracking the back edge of a hood a little bit, one of the Alphas that I used to prep. We would open the back edge of the hood a little bit and potentially bleed off a little more heat and make the system cool better, but at the same time, it had the aerodynamic benefit of potentially decreasing downforce a little bit at the front, which, as I mentioned earlier, because the car was front heavy on downforce, would reduce the front balance and give you a little bit more neutral aero platform to work with.
So it seems like with a production-based car, anyway, you're just as concerned with reducing drag as you are with increasing downforce. Because what's the curve like as far as drag versus downforce? Like, I'm sure in NASCAR you guys deal with this all the time, trying to find that perfect balance between you know, low drag but actually producing some grip. What kind of math are you using, or what sort of rules of thumb are you using to find that balance? Is it just purely a testing thing, or is there sort of a mathematical point that you'll pick to start with and test, you know, bracketing that assumption?
Well, basically, you're looking at the efficiency, and what aerodynamicists consider efficiency is the lift number divided by the drag, L over D, and effectively, if you're working on reducing drag, you want your efficiency for the change, whatever change you've made, to be a bigger reduction in drag than you lose in downforce. So you want your efficiency of that change to be lower than whatever the car's normal efficiency is. And for downforce, you want the efficiency to be higher so that you're making more downforce than the drag you gain. And it all depends on the nature of the car. Because production cars are such low downforce, their efficiencies, our aerodynamic efficiency, is probably down in the 20 to 30% range. Most race cars, old GTP cars from the IMSA days, were pushing efficiencies of roughly 4 or 5 to 1. So they were making 4 or 5 times more downforce than drag. So there's a big swing in full-on race car to production car. And somewhere in the middle would be club racing cars that can potentially do some underbody work or even autocross cars that have the capability of making decent speed on some of the longer courses, where you're probably going to be able to get the efficiency up probably around 1 to 1, maybe even a little bit better.
So even at autocross speeds, in a class where you're limited as to how much aero you can use, there's benefit to be seen from, you know, let's say you get a street mod car where you're only allowed to have, you know, 6-7 square feet of wing area and maybe a splitter that doesn't extend past the front bumper, simple stuff like that. Can stuff like that make a measurable difference at a 40, 50 mile an hour autocross?
Absolutely. The effectiveness is a function of the area. Now, if you're looking at it from the top, every time you double the area, you're effectively doubling the effective force that you're making on the car. So the more, the better. That's why they put an upper limit on it. And even at those speeds, given the right design details, you can make wings and splitters and things of that sort work very efficiently. And even though your limit on something like a splitter might be a top-down view of the car, that doesn't mean that you can't run that splitter further back underneath the car and generate more flat area close to the ground so that you're making that low pressure under the car work on a bigger area and physically make more downforce.
And then what about when you get down in classes like Street Prepared, where you're allowed, you know, an 8-inch spoiler, and people seem to be putting a lot of effort into very precisely setting the angle of their, you know, their clear polyethylene spoilers and putting, you know, bit more build effort into their spoiler adjusters than they are, you know, half the rest of the car. Is there anything significant actually being gained there on some of these cars?
Absolutely. And again, you're looking at the area of the mechanical versus aero drag, that you're light on the aero side comparatively to the mechanical side. So if you can make a lot of downforce, a lot being say 100, 150, 200 pounds at 40, 45 miles an hour, a spoiler like that is probably going to generate maybe half as much drag. So instead of the mechanical drag being, and the mechanical and aero adding up to a grand total of 100 pounds, it might add up to 200 pounds. But for the short bursts on the straightaways that the engine's running, the physical power loss of that extra 100 pounds of drag is not significant enough to slow the car down. But at the same time, the downforce is going to benefit going through the corners because you're less likely to slide the tires. The tires will come up to temp a little faster because you're putting more physical load on them, things like that. So at the end of the day, at those speeds, spoilers are reasonably efficient because they make a lot of downforce very quickly.
And you're not really concerned with the drag because you're not really going fast enough to have it be that significant.
Right, right.
So basically the lesson, I guess, for autocross then would be don't even bother sacrificing for less drag. It's just, you know, purely about trying to make as much downforce as possible, as long as you can still, you know, physically move the car under its own power.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's kind of where the Corvette that showed up at the Challenge a few years back that ran the sucker motor.
Yeah.
Ultimately, if that car was making even a tenth of a PSI difference on the underbody of the car, that tenth of a PSI spread out over the entire bottom of the car added up to, I'm going to take a wild guess at what the area underneath the Corvette is, but it probably added up to 400 pounds of downforce or something along those lines. Might have been more. I'd have to work out the numbers on wheelbase and all that stuff to get a better estimate. But at the end of the day, a little bit of pressure difference makes a big difference on a big area. And the same thing with spoilers, because it's basically you're getting a really low pressure behind it and all the air stacked up in front of it, you get a big pressure differential across it. So you get a lot of downforce. And some of that's just due to the drag leverage, right? So the spoiler is higher than the center of gravity. So pushing back that high up generates rear downforce in the process.
Yeah. Now, for a sucker car, though, it seems like any sucker system is only as good as its seal, and that seems like a highly variable thing. You know, your seal is only going to be as good as you can keep something parallel or against, you know, a highly variable surface. Is that the biggest challenge those guys face?
It is. I mean, it's at the end of the day, you've got to have a fan that has enough, a fan, not a motor, but a fan that can pull enough pressure. Your typical axial fan, like a box fan that you might have in your house, a typical axial fan like that can only get a couple tenths of a PSI difference from front side to back side. So you can't make massive pressure differentials. A centrifugal fan, something like a turbocharger compressor, you can make massive pressure changes from the inlet to the outlet, you know, on the order of 20 or 30 PSI with a turbocharger. So the capability of the fan to A, move a lot of volume, and B, have a big pressure differential is what would benefit sucker cars the most. And then the seals, if the seals are very good and you have a high volume flow, the chances are you're probably going to pull your seals in. You're probably going to fail the seals by physically pulling them off the car. But with low pressure systems, sealing the skirts to the ground is a big challenge. And they've done sliding skirts. I've seen brushes used, you know, like finger brushes to try and seal. And you get some air flow through that. But again, we're looking for pretty small pressure differentials for the area under the car. So sealing it to the ground is a big benefit.
Cool. So I would imagine that in NASCAR, and I don't, you know, I'm not going to try and get you to give any secrets away here, but I would imagine that what you guys are, you know, the cars are so close to begin with, and you're looking for probably tenths of a percent of differences. But it seems like that job is magnified by the fact that you're allowed not much in the way of aero, but also that the loads have to be so dramatic because your average speeds are so high. It isn't like you're going through a 40 mile an hour corner, then an 80 mile an hour corner, then 120 mile an hour corner. You're always going 200 miles an hour at some of these tracks. So you've got these immense loads on the car all the time. And I would imagine there's, you know, just lots of actual like panel deformation going on that's affecting aero and just lots of crazy stuff. Like what's some of the stuff you guys have to deal with way out there at the extreme end of the stick?
Well, what you're describing is called aeroelasticity, basically stuff moving because the air forces on it are big. And you see it on airplanes too. If you're on a 747 getting ready to fly overseas and it's running with heavy tanks, the wingtips droop down. And as soon as the plane starts rolling down the runway, the wingtips, you can watch them physically start to rise up just past horizontal and then actually flare up a little bit at the tip. And that's all the aerodynamics on the wing, physically lifting the weight of the fuel and then finally lifting the hundreds of thousands of pounds of airplane along with it. The aeroelasticity is a tough thing to measure because you can't just walk out into the airstream at the wind tunnel and put a tape measure up against the panels that have moved and figure out how much it's moved. So you wind up having to measure it from inside the car, which is never a perfect science. But the data systems allow us to be able to measure those sorts of things on a regular basis.
So what's a good gain for you in a wind tunnel someday? I mean, if you find something that's going to give you a tenth of a percent difference, is that exciting? I mean, are is that how close all these cars are out there?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately you're dealing with the limits of the wind tunnel. You like to run fast enough at the wind tunnel so that you're at the upper range of the measuring instruments, and that's purely to get more resolution. So if you've got, I'll give you some examples from the Swift tunnel I worked at. Our balance was rated for 480 pounds of downforce. And this is a half scale tunnel, so the loads increase on the cubic function. So a full car that had 480 pounds would have 480 pounds cubed physical downforce. So, anyway, it's what you wind up with is you try and run at the limit of the tunnel, whether that's the top speed of the tunnel or the upper limit of their measuring instruments. And you're trying to get down to fractions of a percent, like you say, just, you know, below 1% changes are pretty big. Because the tunnel measurement systems are generally rated for consistent or for repeatability of less than a percent, generally, you know, tenths of a percent of full scale. So our balance at Swift was, I want to say it was 0.5% out of 480 pounds. So that would have been, 2%, or sorry, 2 pounds out of 480 pounds would have been the limit of our downforce resolution. That's the kind of load you're looking for.
Wow. Yeah. So, all right. So dispel a myth for me or reinforce a myth maybe. There's this notion, and you know, I think of what I know about, you know, the typical tire slip angle curve and how it works and where it generates its biggest lateral force, and you know, my rudimentary understanding of aerodynamics that you know, drag increases as what the square or the cube of speed basically.
Yeah.
So there's this belief that, you know, among people you hear talking about racing who sometimes know what they're talking about and sometimes don't, that there could be a situation where a car could negotiate a corner at a certain speed because of aero benefits that it physically could not negotiate at a lower speed. Are there situations, you know, is there a mathematical possible situation that could exist?
Absolutely. The tire grip is, like you say, a function of downforce and or vertical load. So adding downforce increases that vertical load, increases the grip of the tire, and there is an upper threshold. You know, the upper threshold is you've got so much downforce that you blow the tire out just from trying to squish it into the ground. But ultimately, yeah, there is a phenomena where if you're not going fast enough, one end of the car will slide off the track, where if you go a few miles per hour faster, you'll have enough physical grip to actually make it through the corner without lifting or without having to slow down or speed up, or not being able to speed up anymore, but being not having to slow down.
So getting used to driving a heavy aero car has got to be a huge transition for some of these guys, especially, you know, guys coming from like a Formula Ford to even a Formula 2000. I would think that would be a big difference. And then once they make the jump to like a Formula Atlantic, you know, another big difference, right, in that. You've had the chance to work with a lot of these guys over the years. I mean, do you see a little bit different type of driver in generally that works better in a heavy aero car? Are they more engineering minded? Are they more fearless? What's the personality type there?
I wouldn't say it takes a different type of driver. It just takes a different amount of confidence in the car. If a driver's confident that he can pilot the car with the aero aids, then he'll be fine. I mean, he'll ultimately figure it out. He may tear some stuff up in the process of trying to figure out how to drive it. But moving from a non-aero car to a heavy aero car, you are going to see a pretty steep learning curve where drivers being drivers, they're going to push a little deeper. And then ultimately they're going to find the point that I just can't drive in any deeper, but wow, that's 20 miles an hour faster into this corner than I've ever driven before in anything comparably powered. And I'd say it's less about the mindset of the driver and more about their confidence in the piece that they're driving.
All right. So we got to wrap things up here pretty soon. But before we go, give me a couple of tips for the club racer to go out and, you know, a guy's developed his spec Miata or his ITA car as far as he thinks he can. And he wants to sort of take the next step and start doing some subtle aero tweaks. You know, where do you start on something like that? Is there anything that you can go out to the track this weekend and experiment with and see if that's a realm where you could possibly get some gains?
Yeah, the item we didn't really touch on much and that has a big impact on aero is cooling, and for cars that spend the majority of their life on a racetrack, you can get away with a lot smaller radiator inlet than you would ever be able to get away with on the street. So you can reduce your drag by closing up holes and things like that to feed the radiator and still be able to cool the car adequately on the track, because ultimately you don't want the air going through the radiator too fast. If it's going through too fast, it doesn't have time to take the heat away from the radiator. So you can actually close the inlet up, potentially cool a little bit better, at the same time make less drag and probably a little more front downforce on a front engine, front radiator car. As far as downforce, getting the car down and trying to put a little bit of pitch in it, not too much, because then you run out of front travel effectively. If you start to make too much front downforce and you hit bumps, then you're going to start bottoming out. But putting a little bit of pitch in the car is generally a benefit. If you've got anything that looks like it's a parachute catching air on the outside of the car, fairing it in or smoothing it off, or likewise opening up places where you think there's high pressure under the car to vent it to the top side of the car or to the outside of the car, is a good way to reduce some lift effectively and make some downforce. And ultimately, all the short stubby stuff that we bolt onto race cars, mirrors, antennas, all that stuff that makes for, you know, nice conversations with folks in the pits and being able to see your competitors coming up on you or keeping an eye on them to make sure that you stay ahead of them. That stuff's all really draggy. Ultimately, short, stubby stuff is really draggy. So the more you can fare those sorts of things in, the better.
So is there a better place than others for mirrors? I mean, if you can move your mirror forward or backward in the airstream a little bit, like is there a place you could find to maybe mount a mirror or mount an antenna that's better than another?
It would be a case-by-case basis, you know, depending on the car and things like that. But generally, longer, skinnier things, more airplane-shaped, airplane body-shaped things are going to be lower drag. So if you've got a mirror that's like an old MG-type mirror that's basically a round disc on a stock, that's probably really draggy compared to some of the more streamlined mirrors that are available out there. So ultimately, you can fare those things in and get a better drag result without having to physically move anything.
So takeaway message, the airplanes are shaped that way for a reason, I think.
Airplanes are long and skinny for a reason, yeah.
And actually, I one of the things we didn't touch on that surprises me sometimes is when you see folks that have put a lot of money into aero work but not put a lot of thought into how these devices that they're designed to create downforce are going to translate those downforce loads into the actual chassis. That's got to be an important consideration too, I would think.
Absolutely. Especially underbody panels. Again, we're talking about reasonably small pressure differentials from one side of a panel to another. But if you've only got 2 half-inch diameter bolts holding on a pretty thin aluminum sheet underneath the car, then the chances that those bolts are going to pull out around the material are pretty high. So ultimately, you spread the load out, again, like an airplane, lots of small fasteners instead of big fasteners to spread the loads. And it gives you, you know, some redundancy so that if one fails, they don't all fail immediately after. Some spreading the load out and wing pylons. You see it a lot of times on cars on the interstate, or at least I do, because I entertain myself on my drive to work watching cars with add-on wings and even some of the factory wings where the drag is so high on these things that it's just about ready to rip itself off the deck lid. Reinforcing not only the deck lid where it attaches, but if you're making downforce with it, you've got to support it from the bottom side down into the structure of the car somewhere.
Yeah, and if all you're doing, I mean, if the main thing transmitting force to your chassis is the trunk latch, you know, you might want to spread that area out a bit, I would think.
Yeah. And, something as simple as a reasonably thick spread out plate underneath the mounting pads of the wing that has some sort of bracing down to effectively the unibody or the frame extensions on the back of the car, you know, just to take the load from the body into the structure of the suspension and chassis.
So what are you seeing out there in the last couple of years that you've liked a lot? You mentioned the SAE car with the movable wings. We saw that at Nationals last year. You know, very, very cool thing. There was a trend in AMOD for a while that it was sort of moving away from boxy wings to very high aspect ratio wings were a lot more efficient. Now we're kind of going back to the lower aspect ratio wings again. You know, what trends do you see out there that intrigue you a little bit?
I think what I'm seeing from production type cars is one item is they've all gone to what would have a couple of years ago been kind of tuner fascias where they've got some shapes and basically a splitter sort of kind of built into it and sort of kind of diffuser at the back of the car. But what lets me down a lot of times on that is it's basically just a hollow shell, especially the back of the diffuser area. If you're behind one of these cars, it's got some little bumps in it that look kind of like strakes, but right in front of that, you've got either an exhaust or a fuel tank or something hanging down that disrupts the smooth flow to that piece.
Or just the open inside of a bumper cavity. Yeah,
a big parachute at the back of the car that's catching a fair bit of high-speed air coming off of the rear tires, underneath the car, all that kind of stuff.
Well, nobody ever said it was a crime to look good. But it certainly doesn't help you go any faster. All right, Steve, thanks very much for being with us. This was a lot of fun. My head's starting to hurt. We will definitely do this again and follow up on some of these techniques. Maybe we'll get together after Nationals and see what shows up in some of the mod classes and see what's interesting out there next year.
Yep, and I usually lurk on the forum. So if anyone's got any questions, feel free to post up, and I'll try and answer too.
All right, there you go. There's our chat with Steve Stafford. Hopefully your head is not hurting right now and you learned something and you're all excited to go to the grassrootsmotorsports.com message board and throw some questions up there. I'm sure we'd be happy to hear some feedback or some specific questions dealing with whatever situation you're dealing with. I remember back in the day, he was doing neat stuff with he mentioned an Alpha that he was doing some neat aero work with, and it's amazing how much there is to be gained. Like I think so many of us take this real esoteric brainiac stuff for granted because it's just sort of out of our mathematical grasp, and it's you just don't see air and you don't really perceive it as such a force because it's just sort of this very amorphous, very very complicated thing. But even even back in the day in the early 90s, he was doing little tricks on IT cars, gaining some top end speed, gaining a little bit of downforce here and there, and man, in a especially in a sport like autocross, in a sport that's measured to the thousandth of a second, obviously every thousandth counts. And you talk about what's a big difference. Well, a thousandth of a second is a measurable difference. So any advantage that you can gain from anywhere is significant. So that's why we deal with all this way out there stuff and to try and gain any possible advantage we can. So that is the show for this week. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And if you liked it, please, please, please tell your friends that they can go to grassrootsmotorsports.com. Pardon me, grassrootsmotorsports.com/podcast. And you can get all the archives of, I guess we're up to 27 shows now. Really lots of cool back catalog stuff in there. So, if you're new to the podcast, there's plenty of stuff to get caught up on. And if you're a regular listener, we thank you for that too. And actually, we'll thank you once again by giving you a URL, which is grassrootsmotorsports.com/discount and classicmotorsports.net/discount, which you can go to get a new or renewal subscription to either of our fine magazines. And you're going to get like 20% off of your subscription just by going to one of those two URLs. And it automatically gives you the discount price just by going there. And that's that. I just give that out on the podcast. It's not published anywhere else right now, but if you want to share it with your friends, that's fine. Just tell them, hey, listen to the podcast and go here and get a deal. All right, so that is it for this week. We will see you again next week with another fine podcast. I am JG, Pastor Jack. This is the Grassroots Motorsports Podcast. You are probably in your car or in your shop or doing something cool right now. And for that, I thank you for having us along with you for your listening pleasure. We will see you next week, everybody. Have a great day.